It tends to be the people in power who draw the lines on the maps. Look at the straight borders that run across much of Africa, drawn with rulers by bureaucrats and politicians. Which side of the line you fall determines how you're treated, who represents you, whether you have a voice or even a home. Worst of all is to be on no map at all. Suddenly, no one can hear you and no one knows what you need. But what if we could all change the maps? This is a program about what you could call a mapping revolution, about citizen cartographers trying to reach the world's unmapped people and places. Our story starts in Boston in the USA in January 2010 as the snow starts falling. A new year at Tufts University in Boston for Patrick Meyer and Sabina Carlson-Robia.
So it was a late afternoon and I was in my dorm room.
I had just moved into a small apartment that it was my cousin's apartment.
Watching CNN in the background but doing some work.
And I was unpacking and actually listening to the BBC.
All of a sudden, I see breaking news on CNN.
Literally just over the radio, breaking news.
Massive earthquake.
Earthquake just happened, and there's 2 to 3 houses that broken down.
I just stopped in my tracks. I had no... It was hard to imagine.
It was a big earthquake. It lasted like 15 seconds, I think. It was very, very bad.
It looked like the devastation was really quite something, and I had some very good friends of mine, including my wife, who was in Port-au-Prince at the time.
So Patrick, a PhD student who'd previously worked with online mapping software, flipped open his laptop, fired up a map of Haiti, and tried to figure out what was going on.
My first port of call, so to speak, was Twitter. I didn't expect to see anything, and to my surprise, there were a couple dozen people tweeting live from Haiti / Port-au-Prince. And you know, they were reporting, they were witnessing the devastation and saying, oh, the church has collapsed in this particular area and so, and the school over there, the children have been evacuated.
Using any kind of geographical information he could scrape from the tweets, he started plotting them onto the map.
By the next morning, when the Western media did get to Haiti, you had just a 24/7, you know, mainstream media coverage, nonstop, and then by then social media just exploded.
We need help, international help. Yeah. We ain't got no.
And so I reached out to my friends at the Fletcher School, which is where I was doing my studies, and said, "Hi, I'm mapping Haiti." I mean, I really honestly did not have more of a plan. It was an emotional reaction, and I'm mapping Haiti. And I found out around midnight, by the way, that my wife and my friends were okay. I didn't stop then, though. I was like, okay, let's continue mapping.
Undergraduate student Sabina heard something was going on. She'd lived in Haiti and thought she could help.
People on campus knew I spoke Creole and they called me and they said, Sabina, you have to come to the graduate campus where this was all taking place.
You can imagine a dorm room with dozens of volunteers sitting on the floor, sitting on the sofa, sitting on chairs, and just on their laptops clicking away. We then reached out globally because we had exchange students from London and exchange students from Geneva.
And so an international round-the-clock mapping mission began. Students working shifts. And then, just after a week later, came the text messages. A Haitian phone provider set up a number for people to text if they needed help. But there was one obvious problem. Language expert Robert Munro.
The majority of the messages were in Haitian Creole, which was not a language understood by the majority of the response community. I found and managed about 2,000 members of the Haitian diaspora to do real-time translation of these messages.
That was essential. Without that, nothing that we did would have worked. They came into our system and we had to try to figure out where these people were. I think it was a very strange time for those of us who were very involved. So I'm thinking of a Creole word. I was going to say impressionné. M'garde impressionné, oui? Donc, ça t'a impressionné. It just meaning, literally mean kind of it made a mark on me. And there was this motivation to just do what we could.
But was the map they were creating any use? More than 1,500 miles away, in a ship just off the coast of the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince, Major Arturo Derryberry of the US Marines is trying to find information about a town in the mountains that he knows has been cut off by the quake. He hears about the mapping effort and opens the map.
There were, in fact, distress signals or dots on a map. We sent a couple of CH-53 large cargo helicopters from the ship with a team to validate the needs, and sure enough, the town was destroyed. They needed clean water. A lot of their buildings had toppled. I remember there were three women, one being a child and then two being elderly women that were severely injured. Had it not been for us using open source information that was available, we wouldn't have been out there, and I don't think that they would have survived.
The students in Boston were making what's known as a crowdsourced map, collecting information generated by lots of people, a crowd, to build up a picture of what was happening. Justine McKinnon was part of that effort in Haiti.
Haiti, yes, as a volunteer. I've worked on the Philippines 3 times now, sadly. Samoa.
4 years on, she now helps to coordinate hundreds of volunteers worldwide in crowd mapping efforts, all in her free time and without being paid. I went to meet her at HQ, her comfortable living room on the seafront on Hailing Island in Hampshire, and it turned out to be a timely visit.
Outside, we can hear that there seems to be a storm coming to the UK today. We're hearing a bit about it in the news and on Twitter. So you have been activated. What's happening right now?
Right now, we have created a map. I have the Artificial Intelligence for Disaster Response collating all tweets with identifying hashtags.
Which, to non-tweeters, means fishing out the tweets containing the words Storm UK or Tidal Surge. I'm sorry, that's hashtag Tidal Surge.
Once the geolocations and the tweets are verified, that will be uploaded to the map.
What motivates you to get involved with this?
It's addictive. There is no job in the world that could pay for the way this makes you feel when you actually know that you have saved someone's life from sitting in your sitting room, in your pyjamas, at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's priceless.
Justine's group, Crisis Mappers UK, has about 250 members. But there's another very different mapping movement, which is more than 1 million strong. It's called OpenStreetMap. Its aim is to make an accurate and completely license-free map of the world that anyone can edit. Whereas Justine and those students in Boston plot messages and photos onto a map, these are people literally making the map, adding roads and changing the shapes of buildings. In some cases, cartographers just take off, GPS in hand, to map where no one has mapped before. Some of them are so passionate about the project, they give up their weekends for hack days to try and make the system better. Like this bunch.
I won't lie, there is a certain amount of obsessiveness involved. I think anybody here that didn't say that would be lying. I like things to be right, and I like maps to be right, and I think we all do.
The first thing that actually got me mapping was frustration with existing maps. I mean, for instance, the classic one was I went to a petrol station and bought a map of my hometown just because I needed it for something. And within an hour, I had found 30 errors on it.
It's a fun technical challenge. So looking after such a big project.
It's a bunch of friends, and it actually does a lot of good work.
Many of the maps that responders went into Haiti were, in some cases, years or even decades out of date.
That's John Crowley from the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. He's also a volunteer for the Humanitarian OpenStreetMap team, who, since Haiti, have responded to every natural disaster around the world.
Disasters almost always change the map. A tsunami will change the coastline, an earthquake will knock down buildings. What happened with OpenStreetMap in Haiti was the first time that a volunteer group had essentially mapped a country within a very short time period. It took about 3 weeks for about 640 mappers to make about 1.2 million edits to the central third of Haiti, mapping a country that was one of the most poorly mapped in the world. That allows for the community outside of the country to trace satellite imagery, while the community inside the country can essentially provide ground truth and begin to correct the mistakes that can't be seen from the air, but are only something that you can actually understand with local knowledge and local context.
In the months that followed, Haitians were trained in Haiti to use the mapping tools to improve the map. Incredibly, when Japan was struck by a huge earthquake a year later, it was Haitian volunteers who were the first to start mapping the affected area. It's an effort that more traditional responders respect and are even looking to for guidance. When a typhoon struck the Philippines in 2013, the British Red Cross joined in. Andrew Bray heads up their mapping team.
Suddenly there were these little mapping parties, and there was one in London where they were literally kind of taking the satellite imagery and digitizing it. And for a couple of days, that's what our volunteers in the office were doing. So they were contributing to the same volunteer effort that the thousands of volunteers around the world were doing, because that was the most valuable thing we could do at the time.
The maps directly inform the Red Cross's work.
The quality of the information is amazing. The value is that if it's not there, you can put it there. So if there's a town in Uganda, which is one of the examples from what the American Red Cross did with the humanitarian OpenStreetMap team, they wanted to work in the town. The town was literally not on a map. They put it there, people on bicycles with GPSs, to do their work in Uganda. This whole sort of network that we're plugging into has a massive volunteer component, to the extent that it wouldn't exist without it.
John Crowley again.
As we teach communities how to map, they're understanding their space much more effectively. Curating that is an expense, something potentially best done by an effort like OpenStreetMap, where the communities can curate it. But I have to caveat that and say that many of these efforts also have to be tied into government, so that the government is looking at the data as something that they themselves can also trust.
Having your home on a map means getting a water supply and electricity. Being part of a mapped constituency means voting. Part of a school catchment area means an education. OpenStreetMap came to what's supposed to be Africa's biggest informal settlement, Kibera in Nairobi, in 2009 with a project called Map Kibera. Before then, any official map just showed forest. But now, when it comes to building a new clinic or toilet block, we can see exactly where it's needed, mostly thanks to a team of citizen mappers constantly updating the map using handheld GPS devices. The map also sparked an online citizen news channel that shows people what's happening and where.
Fire erupts at around 5:30 p.m., burning down about 25 houses. This happens 2 weeks after another fire reportedly burned down 4 houses near Maranatha area.
I was questioning, why is everybody doing so much and yet nothing is happening? You know, there's so many NGOs, so many organizations. What is going on? And later on I discovered that they did not see the bird's eye view of everything.
That's Kefa Negweto, head of the project, speaking to the BBC World Service just after the elections in 2013. By then, the map of Kibera was so detailed they could show every parliamentary constituency and every polling station. Their work encouraged politicians to come into Kibera for the town's first ever pre-election debate.
My name is Mikel Marin, and I'm the founder and one of the trustees of the Map Kibera Trust. This started with the mapping of the geographic boundaries of the wards and constituency, the electoral boundaries, and then a election map was produced and distributed to community organizations, to the local administration, to security services. To my view, it was the first time that there was a real full circle from community mapping and reporting activities to something which had a real tangible impact and benefit to the community. If you go into Kibera, I imagine if you went in today and you went to the local administration, you would see the map right up there on the wall. We got great feedback from both local police all the way up to national level that the map was useful.
We know Joshua for KNN in Kibera.
So careful mapping can make a real difference. But citizen mapping isn't completely trouble-free, and some people have started to raise doubts. As the students back in Patrick Meyer's Boston dorm room during the Haitian earthquake were to find out, the amount of data out there is huge, and it's easy to get overwhelmed. A week in, the group read a tweet from an officer in the US Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, the American organization in charge of the aid effort in Haiti. It reads, "The crisis map of Haiti represents the most comprehensive and up-to-date map available to the humanitarian community."
I didn't realize at the time, but that put us under a lot of pressure. I mean, we were like, oh wow, we're making a difference. You know, the professionals are telling us not to stop mapping. That's incredible. We felt energized by that, but at the same time, looking back, talk about just the expectation and just the weight on our shoulders.
They were using an online system developed by non-profit technologists in Kenya called Ushahidi, meaning witness in Swahili. It had been helpful monitoring text messages during elections in Kenya, but what Patrick was dealing with was on a completely different scale.
You know, Ushahidi is basically an inbox connected to a map. You're getting a bunch of emails, and then you can map those emails, right, with the reports. Now, it's a multimedia inbox. So you're getting emails, you're getting text messages, you're getting pictures and videos, but it's still the idea it's an inbox, right? We all hate, I think, our email inboxes, especially when they start exploding and we can't possibly keep up. That's one of the worst things ever, right? So you can just imagine waking up one morning, going to your email, and you see 100,000 unread emails. It was impossible to catch up, and in fact, we were always behind. There was an increasing backlog in our inbox that we never got to. And in many ways, it was a failure. I mean, we still managed to get a few thousand reports on that map, and people thought it was useful. But how many thousands of emails, if you'd like, did we not go through that could have contained really important information?
Robert Munro, who was translating the messages being plotted by the students, has also started to have worries about the consequences of amateur mapping. For a start, there's the issue of security.
Although we asked the crisis mappers not to put messages online, they did this, and you know, there were like the names of girls as young as 14 with their phone numbers who were in unstable housing. In every single deployment where the crisis mappers have got involved so far, we've seen information exposed, sometimes terribly. So unfortunately, just one of the things that you will get with software which is not written by professionals. And so when we're dealing with data for, you know, the most at-risk people in the world, we want that software to be written by the best people in the world.
Crisis mappers have gone on to map civil unrest in the Middle East, Pakistan, and South America. Freelance computer security expert George Chamales coordinated some of these efforts during the Arab Spring of 2011. But now he's also concerned that these maps could have more direct consequences.
What we've seen over the last couple of years is a growing number of examples of these technologies being deployed and the challenges that they face when they're deployed in areas with capable groups who don't want them. Murder is taking place in Mexico where a group believed to be the Zeta cartel have murdered a series of people and left them in public places with notes explicitly stating that these people were killed in response to citizen collection of information using online systems. Whether the people who were murdered were directly related to these deployments is a little bit unclear. However, it is very clear that the cartels and these organizations were aware of these deployments and were using these murders. These people were killed specifically to intimidate other people from taking part in those deployments.
The 1,000-strong group that Patrick Meyer helped to start, now known as the Standby Task Force, now will not deploy in conflict zones. And they say they're much more careful now with what data they publish on public maps of any crisis. They persevere, operating under the theory that they do no harm and they want to help. But as Sabina Carlson-Robia says, the team in Boston were forced to realise this isn't just a case of simply plotting dots on a map.
The national prison collapsed and you had prisoners coming out, and some of those were old gangsters that communities had, you know, surrendered to the police. I mean, think about that, those people coming back. And those are things and stories and dynamics that people like me are never going to know. It's not the technology that's important. The technology is a tool that we use. But what's important is these stories, these politics that are happening and influence in the aftermath of disasters, that there's some way that we start to try and capture that. So yeah, it's it's more than just dots on a map.
And what if those dots aren't accurate in the first place? When anyone can post anything on the internet, how do we make sure that maps that take their information from crowdsourced data are reliable? How do we know what the crowd is saying is actually true? Back in Hailing Island, Justine McKinnon thinks that even given the reliability problem with crowdsourced data, there is enough useful signal in the noise to make it worthwhile.
We can verify reports are accurate
if people are saying they're seeing things, but the geolocation actually shows they're nowhere near. Twitter is actually self-cleansing now. So people tweet things, and then other people in the areas are saying, no, that's not happening.
That's rubbish. And what proportion generally of tweets about any crisis situation are actually useful for building these kind of maps?
So Hurricane Sandy, there was over 2 million tweets, I believe, in the first 48 hours. 0.001% of those were actionable and informative. That still equated to 15,000 words.
Of useful information?
Yeah. And that's 15,000 words more than they would have had.
Justine and Patrick's volunteers are now using a new website that can help cross-check information. When I met Justine McKinnon, she was still dealing with all the information collected when Typhoon Haiyan hit the islands of the Philippines in November. She showed me the system they'd been trialling to collect the information.
You're actually looking at a phone with a photograph. How much damage do you see in this picture? None, mild, severe.
So I can see there's some corrugated iron roof just all over the floor. It looks like a completely destroyed house. I'd say that's severe.
Yes.
Okay. That looks bad.
If you're ever in doubt, don't worry, because that picture will go through between 3 and 5 other people until the same answer is clicked. This one here. What does this tweet refer to? Not relevant, skip, retweets or requests for help needs, infrastructure damage, population displacement, relevant but other, not English.
So it says, sobering perspective, we don't need money, TV, cell phones, we need food, only food, hashtag Philippines. I'd say that's a request for help, needs. There you go, that.
Unfortunately though, there's no location.
Ah, okay.
So unfortunately, there is nothing we can do with that one.
Since those early exciting days of Haiti, people have started to realise that citizen mapping doesn't have all the answers. You need people on the ground to check the data and to give you local context. But these amateur cartographers are not going away. Organisations like the Red Cross are now getting their own volunteers to do the same kind of mapping. And freelance volunteers like Justine in Hailing Island are convinced that whenever and wherever their next deployment happens, they will have a vital part in saving lives.
So now, when you turn your TV on and you see extreme weather reports, typhoon warnings all across the world, what's the first thing that goes through your mind?
I'm prepared by that point. I'm very fortunate I get emails warning me of anything that's impending. So before I'm watching it on the telly, we're ready.